asks each person to choose between heaven and hell, teaching one's decision will have inescapable consequences. Sometimes the New Testament even uses analogies with money to explain the outcome of one's choice. If you invest your resources well, you will be rewarded. But if you invest badly, you will be punished. Matthew 25:14-30. This sort of logic leads people to think that economic success or failure must be a consequence of personal decisions. The consequences of capitalism. In short, the standard capitalist argument is that all the good developments in the modern period, science, technology, increased comfort, increased standard of living, and increased lifespan, are the results of free market capitalism. This argument has a corollary. Those who work hard will succeed, and those who have not succeeded have not worked hard. We believe both claims are false. Let's begin with the second. One of the most foundational myths of capitalism is that wealth is earned through hard work and natural abilities. Those who have talent and apply it towards the pursuit of wealth will rise above the economic class into which they were born. Thomas Piketty's recent book, Capital in the 21st Century, shows that even in the current era, inheritance is a stronger predictor of wealth than earnings. In other words, capital continues to be controlled by family dynasties much more than by those with natural talent. Piketty's research shows that economic inequality will continue to grow unless we make changes to our economic structure, perhaps through a progressive tax system. In short, the actual data undercut the capitalist myth that outcomes in the competition for wealth are determined primarily by your virtue, character, intelligence, and skill, and by how hard you work. It turns out that other factors determine wealth, generally trumping individual factors of the sort just mentioned. Consider these four examples. 1. Your access to capital. Obviously, those who have no money cannot make money on investments, whereas people who are rich can use their money to make more money. In an age of technology and in a global economic system that increasingly favors large businesses, significant capitalization is increasingly the indispensable condition for success in business. Globally, people from the upper classes have far greater access to wealth, while people from the lower classes don't have it and have a far harder time borrowing it. In many Western countries, it is more difficult for people of color to procure major loans, and in most countries, women have a more difficult time with financing than men. Access to capital is also significantly easier in the global North than in the South. 2. Your education and training. In general, salary rises as one's educational level rises. Graduates of the MBA program at Harvard University in 2013 began work with an average starting salary of $120,000. MBA graduates from the University of Madras, one of India's strong programs, begin work at $85,000. People trained in high-tech professions and in business have the highest earning power. Teachers earn less, and their ability to earn decreases still further when they teach younger children. Farm workers and non-skilled workers earn the least. Many living in rural settings, especially in developing nations, have little to no access to educational opportunities. But income correlates with education worldwide. 3. The region of the world you come from. Your region does not determine whether or not you can be a successful capitalist, but it does have some effects. If you are born in a developed nation, you probably have greater access to lucrative markets and better odds of financial success. According to data from the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD, Estonia ranks lowest among the OECD member countries, mostly developed nations, with an average annual wage of $17,323. Worldwide, however, the median household income is only about $10,000, according to Gallup, and the World Bank estimates that in 2010, about 21% of people in the developing world, 1.22 billion people, live at or below $1.25 a day. Another comparative measure used to compute purchasing power parity, PPP, is the gross domestic product divided by a country's population, which yields per capita GDP. According to the International Monetary Fund, when one uses this measure, Qatar ranks the highest in the world at $100,889, and the Democratic Republic of Congo ranks the lowest in the world at $365. Put differently, the PPP is 276 times higher in Qatar than it is in the Republic of Congo. 4. Your race. Around the world, race and ethnicity influence one's income. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, while white Americans made up roughly 75.1% of all persons in 2000, 87.93% of all households in the top 5% were headed by a person who identified as being white alone. Only 4.75% of all households in the top 5% were headed by someone who identified him or herself as being Hispanic or Latino of any race, versus 12.5% of persons identifying themselves as Hispanic or Latino in the general population. One could easily extend this list. The data are readily available, but the message is hard to deny. Numerous factors that are outside the individual's own control determine his or her fate in the free market. Generally speaking, men have advantages over women, white people over darker-skinned people, the already wealthy over the poor, developed nations over developing nations, and urban dwellers over farmers. If your country has a stable currency, a low crime rate, a strong educational system, and a well-developed infrastructure, then you are likely to outperform those who lack these advantages, even if you both bring the same skills and effort to your business ventures. Conclusion. Americans like to use the traditional expression, "May the best man win." But in the sometimes brutal world of global markets, it is frequently not the best man who wins. Indeed, multiple examples suggest that it is often the less virtuous people who win the battle to become rich. These facts also undermine the claim that we should give credit to capitalism for the achievements of the modern period. It is not unguided and unrestrained human competition that has provided the social goods which add the most quality of life for the greatest number of people. Instead, the greatest gains come when people organize themselves into societies that serve the common good in both word and deed. That is, in their core beliefs, as well as in their actual practice. As we will see in the next chapter, successful socialist systems can retain an appropriate place for entrepreneurial activities. Contra traditional Marxism, hybrid systems work. Suitably constrained market forces can benefit the public good. Most people find it counterintuitive that a system motivated exclusively by greed and cutthroat competition would bring the greatest benefits to the greatest number of people. We now see that there is a good reason people find this claim counterintuitive. It is false. Abuses are only overcome when governments, multinational agencies, labor groups, consumer advocates, and a well-organized system of checks and balances all serve as watchdogs over market competition. As we will see in the next chapter, the best solution is neither laissez-faire capitalism nor state ownership of all major industries. As the climate crisis deepens, new kinds of solutions will have to be found that focus on the common good, blending the needs of society, humanity as a whole, and the planet on which we depend. Part 2. From Modern to Postmodern Marxism. Chapter 4. Marxism in the Industrial Age and Organic Marxism. Power Corrupts. In the preceding two chapters, we have taken a close look at the flaws in capitalism, both in theory and in practice. As a theory of human nature, it endorses the view that humans are fundamentally combative, much more prone to competition than to cooperation. Hence, it assumes that the mechanism of market competition, rather than incentives for shared cooperative action, will bring the best result. As a social and political theory, capitalism presupposes a minimalist view of the state, whose primary purpose is negative, to fight off attacks from without and corruption from within. The government's primary responsibility is to allow the markets to function independently, with little to no government protections or guidance in the public interest. As we saw in Chapter 2, this is the economic philosophy known as laissez-faire capitalism. Historically, laissez-faire policies have been combined with government investment in military buildup and the manufacture of arms, as one would expect from a protection-based theory. Philosophically, the two policies go together. The government's role is to protect the nation from any hostile attacks so that its capitalists can amass more wealth, since in theory, their wealth is good for the nation and all of its citizens. Also, winning wars tends to be good for a nation's economy, as is evidenced by economic statistics for the United States between 1917 and 1945. Laissez-faire governments tend to place less emphasis on education, support of the arts, socialized medicine, or other means by which governments normally work for the common good and add to the quality of life of their citizens. Instead, such governments have traditionally invested primarily in their military forces and in infrastructures that contribute to the financial success of their major businesses. Similar to the theories of capitalism, the practices of capitalist systems since Adam Smith have been what one would expect from a philosophy of this sort. Over and over again, when humans are given unlimited power, they use it to enrich themselves, their friends, and their families, no matter what the effects on others around them. The ancient Romans, whose system of emperors, Caesars, has much to teach us about the exercise of absolute power, used to say, "Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely." From the dawn of the Industrial Revolution through the practices of banks and multinational corporations today, persons and businesses that amass large amounts of wealth and power have very often used them for their own gain, at great cost to other people, other nations, and the environment. As we know from organized sports, when human competition is carefully regulated according to clear rules, when it is assigned a specific playing field, and when everyone on the field has equal access to the ball, great performances can result. By contrast, sporting events without a referee often spiral out of control, especially if the stakes are high and people are likely to get hurt. Why would we expect it to be different when free markets are left to function without constraints, unguided by restraints and broader social goods? One does not have to look very deeply into the history of industrialization in the West or into the behavior of multinational corporations today to recognize that unconstrained market forces are a recipe for disaster. Since these principles are so obvious, one has to ask why they have been ignored. Two reasons come to mind. First, powerful people and corporations don't want to be restrained in the practices they can employ and the money they can earn. They exercise their influence in multiple ways to keep governments and intergovernmental organizations from limiting their activities. The other reason is that many people do not believe that there is any alternative. This response is strange, since socialists through the ages have proposed ways to limit the super rich for the sake of society as a whole. It's not surprising that capitalists have sought to disparage Marx and his followers. The last thing they want is for people to get the idea that societies might be run in ways that favor the 99%. But it is surprising that they have been successful, up until now, in much of Europe and North America. More and more people have become capitalist by default. They know the system favors the richest citizens, but they see no alternative. This is a tragic situation. An increasing percentage of the world's population now recognizes that unrestrained capitalism is impoverishing nations, supporting vast injustices, and leading the planet toward environmental destruction. Marxist analyses of the power of the wealthy and the flow of capital, such as the recent book on Capital in the 21st Century by Thomas Piketty, reveal that the free market is not what it claims to be. Socialist alternatives lie ready at hand. Why are they not seen as live options? Marx's modernist assumptions. It is not surprising that economic proposals developed over 150 years ago would need to be updated. What's surprising is that so many of them still turn out to be accurate in the 21st century. Marx wrote early in the Industrial Age, when its abuses were just becoming visible. Economies had not yet diversified, the service sector was small, and globalization was in its infancy. Private banks, though powerful, exercised a small fraction of the control that they currently exert over the global money supply. Each of these more recent developments suggests updates to the industrial Marxism that Marx bequeathed to his followers. In particular, four updates from Marx's modern industrial context to the postmodern context of our day deserve our attention. 1. In the mid-19th century, many people believed that the principles of history are deterministic. They can be grasped and codified in a single, all-comprehensive system. Karl Marx wrote in the context of the great systematic philosophies of Germany and their assumptions about knowledge. On the one hand, these assumptions helped him to conceive an alternative to the capitalist philosophy of Adam Smith. On the other, they also made it more difficult for him to see the specificity of his own context and historical age. The towering influence on the early Marx was Georg W. F. Hegel, the greatest of the German idealistic thinkers. Inspired by the deterministic laws of Newton's physics, Hegel interpreted the flow of history as an inevitable process. His Phenomenology of Spirit and Encyclopedia describe each of the steps by which one stage of history gives rise to the next. For Hegel, the outcomes of history are predictable not because they are determined, bestimmt, by the necessities of natural science. Instead, history and society manifest their own determinism, their own invariant stages of development. At the same time, Hegel was a rationalist. As he wrote, "The real is the rational, and the rational is the real." Because the progression of human history is at the same time the progression of rationality, or the concept, der Begriff, Hegel claimed that the various stages in the historical process can be known in advance by philosophers, once they develop a universal philosophical science. Or, at least, he thought, he could know them. Marx famously turned Hegel on his head. Instead of the progression of absolute spirit unfolding itself in history, he interpreted socio-economic conditions as being the driving force of history. For this reason, Das Kapital offers a study of the unfolding of the logic of capital, as manifested in the progressive stages of socio-economic development, and, in particular, stages in the means of production. Nonetheless, it was still Hegel who provided the framework for this thinking. As a result, Marx accepted Hegel's deterministic picture of history without revision. We have since learned that the deterministic view of human history is inaccurate. Physicists have shown that determinism does not even hold for fundamental physics. Many phenomena of the quantum world are indeterministic. Scientists now study chaotic systems, in which the conditions at a given moment can never be established with enough precision to predict the future states of the system. The conclusions of the chaos theorists became famous through the so-called butterfly effect, in which a single flap of a butterfly's wings in China could have large and unpredictable downstream consequences, such as affecting the weather over Los Angeles. Biological systems are built upon the same principles of chaos theory. while also adding new layers of complexity that further undercut predictability. Social systems multiply the unpredictability exponentially. Not only do they further build upon the complexity principles of the biological world, they also add even greater complexity of symbolic structures and ideas. No laws can predict the great works of fiction or the idiosyncrasies of the powerful leaders who have changed the course of history. Because so many random factors contribute to emerging economic and social developments, it's misleading to speak of necessary stages of social development. Postmodern Marxists still study the power relations of class, wealth, and capital, as well as the ways that workers and their work are devalued and commodified, that is, treated like products that can be bought and sold. But these empirical studies do not need to presuppose a deterministic picture of history. Today, human societies and practices are evolving into a postmodern age. Capitalists have been quick to drop, or at least to disguise, the modernist assumptions of Adam Smith and his predecessors, Thomas Hobbes and John Locke, who created the myth of the capitalist subject, the isolated individual who produces and consumes. For example, leading capitalist theorists of the 20th century, such as Friedrich Hayek and John Maynard Keynes, were careful to avoid Adam Smith's claims about deterministic systems. By contrast, spokespersons for the large socialist economies have not so carefully distanced themselves from Marx's deterministic language. Because these particular modernist assumptions are now widely viewed as inaccurate, misleading, and undesirable, it's important to develop a postmodern, post-industrial, post-deterministic, culturally embedded Marxism for the socio-economic realities of the 21st century. 2. Marx and his early followers believed that workers, once they are sufficiently informed, will act in their own best interest and rise up against the injustices of their employers and the capitalist system. They were optimistic that a more equitable socialist society could then be built. These claims of traditional Marxism reflect in part the deterministic view of history that we have been discussing, but they also reveal several other assumptions of European modernism. The first is a linear view of time and history. Time, the modernists held, is like an arrow. It moves in a straight line from an origin to a final outcome. By contrast, traditional views of time in Chinese and Indian civilization tend to be cyclical. History is built out of a series of cycles. The Europeans then added the belief, known as meliorism, that things are getting better and better over time. In addition, they were deeply influenced by the Jewish and Christian assumption that there would be a final point in history when God would send a Messiah or Savior who would intervene and bring about heaven on earth. According to secularized messianism, social conditions will get better and better over time, until eventually a utopia, an ideal society, will arise. Partly because of his Jewish background, Marx was influenced by these assumptions. Of course, as an atheist, he created a secular version of this history. Socioeconomic forces, not God, will lead to higher and better stages. Moreover, the final stage will not be heaven, but a secular utopia, the withering away of the state and the formation of something like the ideal society. In this society, he wrote, one can hunt in the morning, fish in the afternoon, and talk philosophy at night. Marx looked forward to a future when workers will no longer be alienated from the products of their labor. The value of products will be tied to the real labor that it took to produce them, and to the uses for which they were designed, food, clothing, shelter, instead of being set by the profit-making activities of massive corporations as they move products and currency around the global markets. Marxists today are far less likely to use utopian language. We have seen how powerfully the wealthy fight against reforms of the current system, and how subtly employers and the market can hypnotize workers to believe that if they just work hard enough, they will someday share in the luxury. The evidence is now clear that global capitalism creates and relies on a permanent underclass, living at or below the poverty line. Yet those with even moderate wealth seem willing to accept the injustices of the system, as long as they have enough comforts and access to the latest technologies. The billions of people who lack wealth, comfort, and safety are not so happy about living in destitute conditions, but they lack the education and the power to bring about change. In short, the experience of the last 150 years should make us far less sanguine about the prospects for change. It hasn't helped that some socialist governments have adopted the language of the perfect society and made unreasonable promises to their citizens based on it. At the same time, workers have seen that their governments are not perfect. Some of the old difficulties continue to arise, even in Marxist states. In many cases, workers lost faith in the promises that their governments made, and scholars became disillusioned even more quickly. Defenders of capitalism have been more than happy to point out the failures of Marx's predictions. Instead of separating out the enduring truths of Marxist analyses from the contingent features of Marx's early industrial context, many people have been ready to throw out the baby with the bathwater. In light of this history, postmodern Marxists have learned to temper our claims. The utopianism and secular messianism of the 19th century lie in the distant past. We are under no illusions about the growing power and influence of the 1%, the world's most wealthy. It's true that the global climate crisis is producing a growing outrage about the wasteful lifestyles of the wealthy classes around the planet. Still, although this outrage increases the chances for reforms, it does not guarantee them. There is little that is utopian about our current situation. 3. Marx's work as a social theorist, a historian of economics, and a student of the class struggle remains relevant. These insights can be separated from Marx's role as a modernist philosopher. His efforts, especially in his earlier writings, to prove a doctrine of dialectical materialism using the categories of Hegel's philosophy, are less enduring. At worst, they produce a vulgar Marxism that clashes with the scientific spirit of his work and with core assumptions of an ecological civilization. Karl Marx engaged in a rigorous study of economic systems across history and of the effects of capital on working conditions. His interests were not abstract, however. He intended his results to bring about revolutionary changes for the working class. It is thus unfortunate that Western philosophers have focused on his early philosophical writings as the essence of his work. When one ignores Marx's commitment to careful empirical study and presents his thought as a philosophical system, it sounds arbitrary and dogmatic. On this view, all human history is the consequence of socioeconomic structures. Where Hegel had been a strict idealist, this Marx becomes a strict materialist. In order to avoid Hegel's claim that absolute spirit is the real causal force in history, one denies that ideas have any direct causal effects. Instead, ideas and ideologies are merely a superstructure that has no real influence in history. The dialectical history of production and capital alone determines the flow of human affairs. Ideas are merely epiphenomenal, that is, they are mere appearances, results of the real causes, which are social and economic. Religion and philosophy in particular are entirely illusory. Although we recognize that such sentences exist in Marx's early writing, they should not be taken as expressions of his mature view, nor do they represent his enduring legacy. After all, it would be self-contradictory to write a Marxist philosophy if you believed that ideas have no effects and all philosophies are pointless. Marx knew that careful analysis can reveal the often hidden power of wealthy people and their money, and he sought to undercut capitalist structures through his publications, Hence, he clearly did not believe that human thought is completely impotent. Not every theory in science or philosophy serves an ideology, but Marx's work is a good reminder that some do. The wealthy classes create justifications to make others think that it's fair and just that they own the vast majority of assets and that we work for them. As Marx wrote in The German Ideology, "The ideas of the ruling class are, in every epoch, the ruling ideas, i.e., the class which is the ruling material force of society is at the same time its ruling intellectual force. The class which has the means of material production at its disposal has control at the same time over the means of mental production, so that thereby, generally speaking, the ideas of those who lack the means of mental production are subject to it. The ruling ideas are nothing more than the ideal expression of the dominant material relationships, the dominant material relationships grasped as ideas." Some things have changed since Marx penned these words. For example, teachers are much more likely to belong to the 99%, earning less than carpenters and plumbers. The intellectual class, which, since the 1960s, has largely turned against the upper class, has been largely disenfranchised and dismantled. In the United States today, 76% of the college and graduate school courses are taught by teachers who are hired for one course or one semester at a time, like day laborers, wealthy businessmen, and the economists who serve their interests, now write their own justifications of the system that makes them rich. 4. According to classical Marxism, the natural world forms a backdrop to the class struggle, but only as the stuff of materialism, the contributor of raw materials, and the occasion for work. It may be the stage on which the human struggle is played out, but in the classical presentations, it is not in itself sufficiently incorporated into the analysis. In Chapter 11, we will examine John Bellamy Foster's case that Marx himself pushed beyond these limits. But few of Marx's modernist followers recognized the ecological features of his thought. According to traditional presentations, Marx focused primarily on human social conditions. They argue that, although Marx presented humanity as an integral part of the natural world, he did not extend his concerns about unjust conditions or his ideas about how to fix them to non-human animals. The exclusive focus on the human is symptomatic of European thought in the modern period. The father of modern philosophy, René Descartes, asserted that animals are mere machines. This philosophy of human exceptionalism, which holds that humanity must be analyzed according to separate principles than other living things, dominated European philosophy for several centuries afterwards. Postmodern Marxists reject this stance. On our view, it's not consistent for materialists to categorize humans as unique based on soul, spirit, or any other mental qualities, since empirical studies reveal numerous parallels between humans and other animals. Indeed, animals clearly suffer as severely from capitalist excesses as do humans, if not more so. Also, resources such as land, water, and air do play a central role in defining the nature of and need for work. Humans and non-humans can remain organically connected to the cycle of work and the products that it produces, or both can be relegated to mere means for others to accumulate wealth. Capitalist systems alienate people from their own work and from their home in the natural world. Authors are fond of citing Marx's 11th thesis on Feuerbach. Philosophers have hitherto only interpreted the world in various ways. The point is to change it. The call to change applies not merely to the social world, however, but to the natural world as well. One can well understand how the ruling assumptions of Marx's age tended to focus his attention on human systems, but this one-sided emphasis makes it all the more urgent that we bring out and formulate the ecological dimensions that are implicit in Marx's analysis. Not only is it inconsistent to stop with human systems, It's also clear that the needs of the natural world today cry out for a more robust response than political theorists have made in the past. Humans are not the only victims of capitalist excesses. Postmodern organic Marxism. Given the vast changes over the last 150 years, it is not surprising that many of the modernist assumptions from Marx's day are no longer credible today. What is surprising is that, despite the changes, so many of Marx's insights have stood the test of time. Most people today do not believe that history is a linear progression. Things are not simply getting better and better, meliorism, as the modernists claimed they would. Workers know that most will never own the beautiful houses and luxury cars that appear on their TV screens and on billboard advertisements. Yet they have not, yet, pushed back against their oppressors in the way we once expected. Indeed, many of the poorest people in the world are the greatest advocates of capitalism. To a great extent, the toys of technology and the pleasures of even small ownership have hypnotized the middle class, even as they lose more than they win. Technology has also produced a rise in the standard of living for the working class, creating the illusion that they will someday be wealthy and powerful like the upper classes. Humans often do not act for their own long-term good, much less for the common good of the planet and of society as a whole. What we have learned is that government for the common good requires balancing market forces and social principles, the needs of humans, and the needs of the environment. We have learned that the dialectics of culture are as important as the theory of dialectical materialism, for history also manifests a dialectical relationship between culture and economic conditions. Culture, which includes not only physical structures, but also a vast range of ideas, values, practices, mores, and religious beliefs, deeply molds every aspect of the class struggle. As we will see in the next chapter, the radical transformations of Marxism in Russia and China had everything to do with deep and long-standing features of Russian and Chinese culture, features unique to the history of a particular people. To reject modernism is to inaugurate a distinctively postmodern form of Marxist analysis that seeks to learn from the dynamics of culture in order to bring about societal reforms. Here, Marxist principles and cultural studies become allies. Cultural studies reveal how greatly policy decisions are influenced by cultural differences, even within different regions of the same country. It takes immense cultural sensitivity to apply socioeconomic insights to different cultural ecosystems. Marxist theory faces vastly different cultural worlds as it is applied in Western Europe, Latin America, Russia, China, and elsewhere. Organic Marxism grows out of these more recent insights. We retain the core principles of Marx's social and economic analyses, but we break with the modernist assumptions that dominated European thought in the 19th century. The question is not whether Marx has been verified or falsified by subsequent history. After all, we note that the best-selling non-fiction book in the United States as we revise this chapter is a book on Marxist economics, Thomas Piketty's Capital in the 21st Century. Instead, the question is what one can learn from the last 150 years. By combining the best of Marx's insights with the evolving postmodern worldview, we obtain the basic platform of organic Marxism. 1. History is not deterministic, but open-ended. No single, all-comprehensive system can ever capture the complexities of civilizational change. Change occurs as part of organic processes, in human social systems as much as it does in the biosphere. The metaphors for unpredictable processes are drawn from networks, webs, and ecosystems, not from the deterministic and closed systems of Newtonian physics. Because all of these are open-ended processes, postmodern Marxism is best understood as a form of process philosophy. Interestingly, This is an insight that one finds also in the work of Engels. In his Socialism, Utopian and Scientific, he wrote, "The great merit of Hegel's philosophy was that for the first time, the whole world, natural, historical, intellectual, is represented as a process." This insight that process permeates all reality also lies at the heart of traditional Chinese thought. In a genuinely Chinese reformulation of European Marxism, one expects to find that open-ended processes are given an increasingly prominent role. 2. There are no promises that human history will simply get better and better over time. Neither changes in class structure, nor improvements in technology, nor more selfless human beings are likely to produce a utopia on this planet. Organic Marxism emphasizes growth and the striving for a healthy, blossoming society. But one can conceive societal improvement without needing to imagine some ideal, utopian state in the future. In the postmodern context, process of improvement replaces progress toward perfection. Managing a society is not like assembling a puzzle out of perfectly designed pieces. It is more similar to bricolage, construction achieved by using whatever comes to hand, from the French bricoler, to putter about. The French philosopher Jacques Derrida famously utilized this notion to explain his deconstructive postmodern position. "The bricoleur," says Levi Strauss, "is someone who uses the means at hand, that is, the instruments he finds at his disposal around him, those which are already there, which had not been especially conceived with an eye to the operation for which they are to be used, and to which one tries, by trial and error, to adapt them, not hesitating to change them whenever it appears necessary, or to try several of them at once, even if their form and their origin are heterogeneous." This is a very different model of social management than either the laissez-faire approach of the early capitalists or the social engineering approach of the social philosophers in the tradition of Max Weber. The model is closer to the gardener or farmer who labors in his fields, surrounded by a profusion of growth. One has to work with the plants and the soil and the weather. The farmer has clear goals in mind, healthy plants and a good harvest. But he is not an engineer, building and assembling everything he touches. He works organically, cooperatively, and symbiotically with the growing things around him. This model also draws on more cautious predictions about the working class. The more impoverished classes, like all other groups of humans, will often act contrary to their own best interests. Nevertheless, real reforms are possible at every level. Societies can be structured for the common good, or they can continue to be organized to produce wealth for small numbers of citizens. Governments can serve the 1%, or they can serve the 99% of the population. The art of management, both in the private sphere and in the public sphere, is to deal skillfully with the reality that people often make badly informed decisions and focus too much on short-term gains. The goal of reforms is to create conditions so that people know their options and the long-term consequences of their decisions. 3. Marxist social and economic analyses include, but also extend far beyond, matters of production and capital. Human beings are thinking, symbolizing creatures, and what we think has huge effects on how we structure our societies, ideas, beliefs, art and literature, philosophy, and even religion. All of these can play major roles in addressing the inequities of wealth and poverty and the injustices between the classes. Part of the excitement of the organic process approach to Marxism is that it includes all dimensions of reality within its framework. Contemporary Marxists are able to adapt the traditional language to semi-capitalist systems, to the social democracies of Northern Europe, to the volatile societies of Latin America and Africa, and to increasingly technologized populations with a comfortable and satisfied middle class, to name just a few examples. In each case, one is able to trace the roles played by class, capital, and power. The vocabulary changes, but the core dynamics are the same. As Marx saw, humans are social animals, embedded in and influenced by history, culture, social class and rank, economic conditions, and type of work. Culture includes far more than the material conditions of our existence. Organic analyses of interconnections do not treat any one dimension as foundational. They lay out the entire range of what Marx, following Feuerbach, called our species being, Gattungswesen, in its connection with other agents in our biological and social ecosystems. Only from this synoptic perspective can one guide and manage human development for the common good. 4. Any viable Marxism for the 21st century will consider humans in the entire context of their existence on Earth. All living things, all natural resources, in short, the entire planet, is relevant to the class struggle. Capitalist structures and practices have raped and pillaged the entire planet, not just human beings. Marxism, therefore, is and must be at its core an ecological and environmental philosophy. For example, the Marxian concept of alienation offers a framework for thinking about the human relationship to nature, not just the relationship of some humans to other humans. In the postmodern context, we are learning to recognize the applicability of Marx's alienation theory far beyond the contexts of work, production, and capital. The widespread sense of dissatisfaction on the part of the middle classes in multiple cultures begs for Marxist analysis. Look, I have achieved all of this. What now? Having all this, why do I still feel empty? Why do I sense that there must be something else, something higher to live for? The planetary ecological crisis, climate disruption, the rapid loss of biodiversity, the dangerous pollution of the Earth's air and soil, these are issues that call for urgent responses from governments and the global community. Already, nations are being forced to manage the secondary social and economic consequences of these primary challenges. It is increasingly likely that the disruptions that lie ahead will lead to revolutionary changes in the roles and responsibilities of governments and the global community. The coming crisis is an unprecedented opportunity for rethinking what it means to structure societies for the common good. Only a Marxism built on organic principles will be able to respond productively to these demands for new political theories and new roles of governments in an era of environmental catastrophe. Over the coming decades, as governments are managing the fallout from ecological mismanagement, we predict that the principles of organic Marxism will play an increasingly important role. Chapter 5. From German Marxism to Culturally Embedded Marxism. The Many Marxisms. One of the central claims of the organic framework we are considering is that struggle for an equitable and sustainable society is always embedded and embodied within a particular cultural context. Societies do not develop according to universal laws, and not every society progresses through the same stages in the same order. Technological advances on one hand and environmental catastrophe on the other may alter the dynamics of the class struggle. Based on the evidence available to them, Marx and Engels expected that communist reforms would come most quickly in industrialized societies, since they represent later stages in the evolution of capitalism. In order for the proletariat to develop its class consciousness, society must develop to the point where the capitalist owners severely exploit the workers, taking away the value of their labor as profits. Not only has the bourgeoisie forged the weapons that bring death to itself, it has also called into existence the men who are to wield those weapons, the modern working class, the proletarians. In proportion as the bourgeoisie, i.e., capital, is developed, in the same proportion is the proletariat, the modern working class, developed, a class of laborers who live only so long as they find work, and who find work only so long as their labor increases capital. As it happened, however, communism found its most famous applications in nations that had not yet developed into full-fledged industrial societies, nations that Marx and Engels would have defined as feudal. Marxism moved eastward, first to Russia and later to China, despite these countries' lack of a large industrialized working class. Communism was attractive in these contexts, not because these societies were ready for the transition, by Marx's criteria, but because they contained a large set of people who were frustrated with the blatant injustices in their societies. It turned out that poverty and oppression constituted the best soil for Marx to grow in. Each time Marxist principles have become embodied in a new cultural context, they have been modified to suit the economic, social, and cultural characteristics of that place and time. The implementation of communism has differed very significantly in the Russian and Chinese contexts. Although later versions of communism do not exactly match Marx's original vision, they have all drawn on the ideal of a more just and equitable society. Marx's principles ask leaders to institute reforms for the sake of those who are the most disadvantaged. They call for constructive alternatives to capitalist exploitation of workers and nature. The basic social and economic ideals do not change, even though the means for implementing them and the specific solutions that are implemented vary greatly from country to country. In order to underscore the crucial role of these cultural differences, in this brief chapter we sketch the evolution of Russian and Chinese Marxism. Even for experts, it's helpful to pause and consider the implications of these narratives of historical and cultural adaptation, for they take us to the heart of the new postmodern Marxism. In each case, Marx's thought was applied in new ways, consistent with cultural and religious patterns that predated the arrival of Marxist ideas. Even when Marxist leaders themselves believed that they were making a complete break with their nation's past, key elements of that past continued to appear in their efforts to build a communist state. In China in particular, this adaptation to a unique cultural context is giving rise to a distinctively postmodern Marxism, which sometimes contrasts sharply with the cultural context of Marx's own 19th century German context. One of the surprising phenomena in both Russia and China was that some leaders did not acknowledge the debt that Marxism in their country owed to the great traditions of their own past and to the unique cultures of their people. Essentially, they treated Marxism as a modern paradigm even while their efforts were transforming it into a postmodern one. Chinese leaders are now correcting for this modernist prejudice. We believe they are paving the way for a new understanding of Marxism in China that takes into account its constructive postmodern potential. Marxism in Russia. In the 19th century, Russia was experiencing rapid social change. It lagged behind Western Europe in science and industry, and its agricultural system still relied on a rural peasant class that constituted over 90% of the population. The Tsar ruled the country with absolute authority, and there was little opportunity for others to influence public policy. Between the peasants and the Tsar stood the rigidly defined social classes, including the nobles who owned the land, clergy, state officials, merchants, and urban workers. In short, the form of Russian society was, as Marx would say, feudal. It was made up of many distinct, fixed classes and was mostly rural. After Russia's defeat in the Crimean War, 1856, Alexander II began to make sweeping social reforms in Russian society, abolishing serfdom, allowing greater freedom to the courts and local government, expanding industry, and encouraging capitalist investment. The expansion of industrial capitalism brought Russia into closer contact with Europe, exposing her still further to Western ideas. Her leaders were driven by a desire to catch up with Europe, to compress within a few decades the scientific and technological progress that had taken other nations centuries to achieve. Drawing upon European experience, Russia was able to leap quickly from an economy still medieval in many respects